Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. My next guest has got to have the most unusual book title of the month. It's Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals. What the author, Ken Ballin, is trying to do is to find some of the roots of terrorist extremism in the personal lives and community context of those few Muslims who commit themselves to terrorist acts. He takes us into the lives of six young radicals in particular, their family lives, their religious lives, their sex and love lives. Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals, has a foreword by CNN terrorism correspondent Peter Bergen, who says we learn here not just about the subject's obsession with the United States as the cause of their problems, but also about decaying family and tribal structures and intense sexual repression. With me is Ken Ballin, author of Terrorists in Love. He's a former federal prosecutor and congressional investigator, interrogator of terrorism suspects, and the founder of a group called Terror Free Tomorrows, which investigates the causes of extremism. Welcome to WNYC, Ken Ballin.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Why the cheeky title, Terrorists in Love?
Well, because the book really tells a story of kind of a missed love for most of these fellows. There's one guy who has a childhood sweetheart. He is passionately in love with him, and he is passionately in love with her. He can't find the $30,000 dowry to marry her. So he goes off to fight on jihad so he can marry her in heaven.
Literally marry her in heaven.
Literally marry her in heaven. This is not some kind of figurative or metaphorical notion on his part. He believes that that's how he'll marry her.
You open the book declaring that torture doesn't work to learn things from terrorism suspects, and that your style as a prosecutor and interrogator was to develop a bond with the people you were questioning over the course of hours and days. So tell us a little bit about your background in that kind of work.
Well, as a prosecutor, what I found, for example, I prosecuted a case with the mafia. I spent literally years listening to wiretaps, knowing their intimate thoughts. And then when we arrested the first round, I would spend days and weeks with subjects, knowing everything about them so that they would cooperate. And that's how I was able to successfully prosecute these folks. Now, we haven't done that since 9/11. We have not tried to know the people who are our adversaries. We have reacted. But you couldn't take down the mob with that kind of model. And I believe it's very flawed in trying to approach radicals and terrorists around the world.
So just so I'm not overstating your role, you did not interrogate terrorism suspects in particular. You investigated other kinds of people in your prosecutor work?
As a prosecutor, I did have a terrorism case, a case related to the financing of terrorism. So, yes, I had experience with that. And I also investigated and prosecuted, apart from organized crime, international drug dealers, including from the Middle East. So I have a lot of experience in this area. And it is through patient questioning and interrogation, not through torture, that we'll find the answers.
And you write that terrorism suspects, as suspects in general, open up to you personally more than most people would ever expect. Why would they go into these things that we'll continue to discuss?
Well, the motives vary for every person, but I found as my time as a prosecutor and investigator, people generally like to talk, and they like to talk about themselves. It's kind of a human trait. So if you get to talking with people, they like to talk. Now, these, a lot of times with criminals, they have a huge sense of guilt. So over time, they want to unburden themselves to somebody. And that was true for some of these folks, particularly one fellow in Pakistan who spent two decades killing literally thousands of people. He was riddled with guilt over his actions. Others have a religious mission, and people who are very devoted to a cause like to share that cause with others, like to convert you.
You mentioned the guy who thought he would join his girlfriend in heaven if he committed a suicide bombing. Are any of the others you profile in Terrorists in Love driven to terrorism at all by their romantic or sexual lives?
Absolutely. One fellow, his name is Ahmad. He came from Saudi Arabia, too. He had never met a woman before. Actually, he went on a suicide attack. The truck bomb blew up. He survived the suicide attack and was taken Brian to, of all places, Abu Ghraib. At Abu Ghraib, he was nursed back to health. It's kind of like the English patient. He met an army medic who showed him a tremendous amount of kindness and care. He opened up to the Americans. And as he said to me, I was used by al-Qaeda as a piece of rotten bait, but the Americans who I came to fight against nurtured me back to health. So he hadn't had love in his life either.
Ironic, because one of the things that Abu Ghraib became famous for was sexual humiliation of some of the inmates.
That's very ironic. And in fact, photos of Abu Ghraib was what motivated him, was the initial shock, if you will, the initial impetus for this young man to leave Saudi Arabia and fight for Iraq. So actually, it was very interesting. He told me when he was being taken to Abu Ghraib, he was in a panic because he thought this was going to happen to him. And instead, in his story, he got 30 operations because he was very badly burned throughout his body. Very badly, his limbs were mangled from the attack, as you can imagine, the failed attack. It didn't fail because 8 other people were killed.
What was Peter Bergen referring to in his intro to your book when he mentioned intense sexual repression?
Well, I think you see intense sexual repression with Abby. He can't make love to Miriam. He can't experience love. With this other fellow from Saudi Arabia, it's the same story. In the Taliban, they're not allowed to have these kinds of any kind of romantic attachments. There's another fellow from Saudi Arabia who, instead of a woman, fell in love with a man, which was also forbidden. In so many of these stories, I'll give you one example which is very compelling. In Pakistan, a son of his grandfather was one of the people involved in helping to found the Pakistan is a Muslim state. His father was a colonel guarding nuclear weapons, very high-level family. He's sent to secular schools. He's raised in a more or less secular environment. He is raped at 11 years old, brutally. Several years later, he too falls in love with a young woman. But the response of the society is again to beat him. His only outlet for love is to God. He can't form any human attachments.
How does that make him hate the United States?
It doesn't necessarily make him hate the United States. It makes him want to be a very good Muslim. And by being a very good Muslim, sometimes some people are carried too far. One of the untold stories that this book exposes is how al-Qaeda and the Taliban manipulate and use a lot of very vulnerable young men who are devoted to doing good, but then are twisted in their thoughts by the manipulation of some of the leaders. The corruption, we don't see that too often. And this book exposes the inside corruption of these organizations.
And you write about at least one of these six who kind of becomes a suicide bomber or an attempted suicide bomber because he wants to be a hero.
That's exactly right, because he wants to be a hero and he can go to heaven. Others don't know they're going on a suicide attack, like Ahmad. He wasn't told that he was going to be blowing up. The two other jihadis he was riding with the truck in jump out right before the target. And he has no other choice but the truck is actually moving forward, and then it's blowing up. He didn't know that would be a suicide mission.
Right.
So, but, and this happens often to these fellows.
But they're for not, others, it's one thing to want to be a hero. I'm sure lots of American kids join the military because they want to be a hero. They've had some kind of kid fantasies about that. You know, maybe people become first responders for that reason, too, in some cases, police officer, firefighter. But they're not going to die.
They're not going to die, or they're not...
They're not going to die, purposely.
They're not going to die, literally, as you just said. And that was interesting, too, because when Ahmad got to Iraq, he was sitting in a room of 45 jihadis who all volunteered for the cause, and a leader of al-Qaeda came before them and exhorted them to suicide missions and asked, who would volunteer? Nobody raised their hand.
My guest is Ken Ballin, former prosecutor, author now of the book Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals. We can take a few phone calls for him, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Who is Kamal, who you seem to get especially close to and fond of in the book?
Kamal is a son of one of the leading religious figures, not only in Saudi Arabia, but perhaps in the Muslim world. He is being groomed to take over the Wahhabi establishment, the religious establishment of Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is the home to the two holiest places in Islam. And it's also the home to a very puritanical interpretation of the faith. It's also the home of a quarter of the world's oil resources, which gives them vast wealth. Kamal was an heir to this. Kamal became radicalized because he fell in love with his first cousin, who happened to be a man, and this was something that was denied to him in that society. Certainly in the sense that he could live openly union with this man, that wasn't allowed. So it radicalized him. He got on the internet. He saw this as a path to becoming a better Muslim, and he got deterred from that path. But I'm going to say I want your readers to read how in the book. I don't want to give everything away over the air.
It's a funny way to become an anti-Western terrorist, be a gay Saudi who society rejects.
Yeah, well, that's right. So you see the role. That's why the title of the book, Terrorists in Love, because you see the role. It's kind of ironic,
yeah.
But you see the role of love or a misloved in almost all these stories. Not all of them. I mean, Zeddy is kind of more of a thug. I mean, and it gives you he's more of a leader and a thug. But you see the role of young love in these young men's lives.
Near the end of the book, by the way, Kamal is shocked to learn that Osama bin Laden, who I guess he admired at some point, liked the TV show Bonanza.
That's correct.
He did?
Well, I don't know. He's shocked. He was very amused by that fact. He would kid me on that. Kamal was a great aficionado of American TV shows. He was actually tutored by an American in all sense of person.
Good English.
He had impeccable English.
But the Lorne Greene character, who represents a solid father figure to most American viewers, represented the archetypal ugly American to Kamal.
That's right. Always has the answer to everything, always blah, 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 always talking, always telling everyone else to do, which is kind of the lesson I took away from all these encounters, is that the United States, we need to go back to speaking softly and like T.R. Roosevelt said, and carrying a big stick, because what people don't resent the most is the United States trying to impose its will on them. I also, in part of my research, we did a public opinion poll in Saudi Arabia. And the things that Saudis wanted the most for the future, beyond anything else, was free elections, free press, free speech. The policy they resented the most, hated, in fact, from the United States, was the United States trying to impose its vision of democracy on them.
With that repression of free speech, how do you think you got honest answers to your poll questions?
Well, I think we got honest answers because people disagreed with King Abdullah's policies on Israel, and they openly disagreed with it. So if they were willing to openly disagree—
He was too soft on Israel?
He was too soft on Israel.
I don't want to overgeneralize from your book to what leads people into terrorism. I mean, people have grievances against the United States that are political. Some people have, you know, religious fervor that leads them to want to impose a caliphate on as many countries of the world as they can, Sharia law. So how much do you want to generalize from the six stories that you tell here in Terrorists in Love that family or community dysfunction leads them to bin Ladenism?
I do want to generalize because I want to tell you it's a mixed of factors that lead people to jihad. It's not just... Obviously, there are political factors. Obviously, there are religious factors. But when you scratch the surface, what the United States has done since 9/11 is generalize about people. And that's a mistake. And people's motives are always mixed. People's motives are always complex. And I found that when I was prosecuting people. There's no one reason someone becomes a criminal. There's no one reason. And just because you're a criminal, this may sound somewhat strange, or just because you're even a terrorist or radical, doesn't mean you're a bad person. Sometimes you're a good person, but are misled down a path that's dangerous. So if we respond that everyone's a bad person, we could be creating more of a problem for the United States in the long run than we're solving.
It's hard to describe somebody as a good person after they drive a plane into the World Trade Center.
It's very difficult to describe them as a good person, and I don't say there's a lot of evil. Osama bin Laden is obviously an evil man. And how he manipulated young people who didn't even know what they're doing proves his venality. But that doesn't mean if we get into a very black and white view of the world, we put on blinders and we fail to understand. And then we're in the position of only reacting to people, either imposing our will or reacting militarily. And that's coming from a position of weakness, I maintain, not strength.
Jamel in Wayne, you're on WNYC with Ken Ballin. Hello.
Yeah, hi, good morning. My question is, guests are saying that it's a generally lack of love or sexual activity. What age group did you find these people committing suicide acts? Because on the onset of puberty, the sexual desires are the most intense.
Yes, thank you. And they are mostly young males, right?
They are mostly young men. And even one who's an older man, closer to my age, he's now in his 50s, you know, he even said I acted like an adolescent when I was doing this. I was after power and glory and whatever, adolescent kind of desires. And this really is a phenomenon, just like criminal activity is largely a phenomenon that's limited. You know, you take the population between 16 and 30 in the United States, and young men who are criminals, that's your, you know, two-thirds of them fall into that age group.
So what about the whole 72 virgins in heaven thing as a reward for suicide bombings? People joke about that, but is it a real belief? Does it motivate any terrorists?
It's a real belief, and it motivates a lot of people. It's a real belief. And when you don't have love on earth, the idea that you're going to have love on heaven can be a very powerful motivator, And it's part of serving God. So the change has to come from people in the book, like Kamal, who go through a transformation, who study the holy texts of Islam and see a different path than what bin Laden prescribes. That's the hope for not just Islam, for the United States in the long run.
You wrote in this book about the closeness of Pakistan's intelligence service to the Taliban in Afghanistan. That became a big media story just recently when the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA director said it before a congressional hearing, but it was already in the galleys of your book before it had gone to press?
It was already in the galleys, and in fact, the person who was telling me about it was paid for by the ISI, and he told me that the ISI was harboring bin Laden in northwest Pakistan, and he lives near Abbottabad where bin Laden was being harbored. He trained terrorists in that same area. So in a big camp for terrorists that was funded by the Pakistani government. So when I heard where bin Laden was captured, I wasn't surprised.
So why did Panetta and Mullen, the CIA director and the Joint Chiefs chairman, suddenly make a big show of the ISI collaborating with the Taliban a couple of weeks ago?
Maybe they read the galleys of my book.
Maybe.
Maybe. No, I think this was something that intelligence officials have known for a while.
Yeah.
I'm not the only one who knew about it.
But now they're making a big show of it.
Well, because the level of frustration is rising to the point. As Zeddy, the commander who trained terrorists, told me, he said, "You Americans are literally funding both sides in the war on terror. While you're giving $20 billion to the Pakistani government, we are training and arming the Taliban to kill Americans in Afghanistan." It is a difficult situation for the United States.
You also write a bit about what goes on behind closed doors in the Saudi royal family. What was your access like?
Well, it was very good through Kamal, who was a member of the religious branch of the Saudi royal family. It's the religious people, it's this, the descendants of a Wahhab, who in many ways have more power than the royal family of Al Saud itself, who they're allowed to intermarry with, because that family gives the Sauds religious legitimacy in Saudi Arabia, which in the other Arab countries, some of the ruling monarchies don't have, for example, in Jordan.
Can any particular good come of your book? These are really, really interesting stories, but ultimately you're the founder and president of a group that tries to fight terrorism.
That's right. But I believe what I said earlier is the good that can come out. By understanding, as a prosecutor, I try to understand the people I was prosecuting. That led to successful convictions. I think the United States, we need to adopt that model. We need to understand. We need not broaden the enemies. We need to identify who's really an enemy and why they're an enemy. If they're an enemy for religious belief, I think that's something we need to grapple with differently than force of arms.
Before you go, what do you think of the killing of Alaki in Yemen, since he had been the inspiration for so many young people into Islamist radicalism in recent years? How much of a blow is it to the movement that he as an individual is dead?
Brian, can I tell you something that's probably going to surprise you and surprise your readers, listeners, and hopefully readers of this book.
And of our website.
And of your website, exactly.
Twitter feed, Facebook page.
You name them all, and hopefully it will surprise all of them.
It's a radio show with readers. Anyway, go ahead.
There you go. But not one person I've interviewed, over 100, ever gave me the reason for joining jihad was to follow bin Laden or follow Anwar al-Awlaki or any other person. They really view this as a religious fight or a fight that they join because of precepts, and they don't necessarily listen to individuals. And while an individual may inspire someone, I think the United States is mistaken to think that just by taking out one or two people that we're going to impact the ideas. We're creating new martyrs when we do that, and there's a cost-benefit that we have to keep in mind. So far, probably we've done the right thing with these two individuals, certainly with bin Laden, but we've got to be careful. We keep taking out individuals. That doesn't mean the ideas and the movement dies.
Ken Ballen, B-A-L-L-E-N. He's a former federal prosecutor and congressional investigator, founder of a group called Terror Free Tomorrows that investigates the causes of extremism, and his new book is Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC. Coming up next, three free trade agreements that you might love or hate. And we'll look into one of America's biggest medical device failures in years. Now we know it's affecting some of the many people who have gotten metal-on-metal artificial hips. Stay with us, and we're also awaiting word from Trenton. Governor Christie expected now to announce his presidential ambitions or not today, and it could come during the show.